Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi. And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 7th, 2016. Amazing, here we are in July. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, the Right Honorable Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, good. I'm glad to have you here, as always. So, D.R., I think that it's appropriate in this podcast to discuss some events that are profoundly disturbing for many people and have a connection to the issue that we like to talk about a lot here. Over the last few days, there have been, two incidents of police shootings of black men. Mm-hmm. Right? And it brings us back to a topic that we have been seeing with discouraging familiarity lately. Mm-hmm. And I guess I wanted to present the idea that climate hawks have a stake in these issues and how they unfold, that climate hawks should recognize a kindred spirit with people who are agitating against police violence explicitly and in general, sort of the Black Lives Matter, for lack of a better word, racial equality. I'm not even sure what the right phrase is there. And I guess I have to, tread carefully and apologize for saying things that reflect my own sort of naivete about all the issues. But it seems as if the shootings in New Orleans and in Minnesota, Minneapolis, I think, precisely,
It's a St. Paul suburb.
St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Right. Is that for a climate hawk, they should recognize in people who are working against police violence, and just to be explicit there, we are both working to change the mindset of a larger group of people. Right. Mm-hmm. And we should look across the aisle and say we are stronger together. Right. And I mean, aside from the moral outrage of the whole thing, I mean, just from a political perspective, climate hawks and the Black Lives Matter movement, again, for lack of a better word, should recognize their commonality, especially when it comes to issues like environmental justice, which has a direct climate connection. I mean, you look at Flint, all this stuff. It's. I don't know. I mean, you are clearly aware of what's going on. What's your take on my incoherent sort of?
It's not incoherent at all. It's perfectly coherent in the sense that both climate hawks and the Black Lives Matter movement are fighting against unfair and oppressive systems. Whether it's the system of pollution and organized pollution, politically powerful pollution, or the system of, weaponized law enforcement. We talk about, I think it's called Section 1033, the government policy that basically allows, this sort of militarized version of policing. And when you combine that with people who enter into law enforcement who may not be perfectly trained or may not be, shall we say, culturally attuned, it creates a devastating, devastating series of circumstances for people who are put in positions of vulnerability.
And I agree with you. And I think that at some level, everyone is vulnerable to the, as you say, systemic abuse of corporate power to pollute. And I think the communities of color are particularly vulnerable to this kind of, I'm not trying to throw every policeman under the bus, right? I mean, it's clear there are many honorable police, but I mean, it's a systemic power thing, right? I mean, and I think that climate hawks should, I guess what I'm calling for is that climate hawks should be ready to speak out and say the word, right? Yes. To say the equivalent of, I joke often, the equivalent of Voldemort. I mean, for a long time, you couldn't say climate change because it was political. It made people uncomfortable, right?
Yes.
And racism makes people uncomfortable. They don't want to discuss it. And, of course, but we've talked before about this concept of the Overton window, which is what are the political topics that are legitimate to discuss? What's on the radar screen? What is too extreme, too crazy on either the left or the right to be considered? And it's important that it's only by speaking about the issues that it becomes normative. It becomes acceptable to talk about climate change or this kind of built-in racial prejudice. And I think the police are just, again, this is just me, right? So tell me if I'm wrong, but that, I mean, the police departments are just an extension of, the power of the dominant sort of white majority, right? The police are around to protect them against the other. And it's just horrifying when you start to think about it that way.
I would say that, you know, you have to sort of put people in a position of discomfort. Sometimes you have to sort of afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, as the old saying goes. And if you think about another parallel of the partner of the Philandro Castile, who is the gentleman who was shot to death in the St. Paul suburb, she was at a protest and she said something to the effect of, you know, the people who are supposed to protect and serve us are assassinating us. And I thought about the obvious parallel to, you know, entities that are supposed to nurture us, to provide us energy, are also killing us as well.
It's
two different forms of state-sanctioned, state-approved, state-subsubsidized murder.
And at the same time, to my mind, it is in parallel between sort of global warming, environmentalism, and racism. It is a dismissal of the legitimacy of other humans, right? The dismissal of legitimacy of people, that are of color in the United States. And throughout the, I mean, it's also climate change. I think for many people who are sort of, I don't know, in the great unwashed out there, you know, they say, okay, something's happening in Africa or Bangladesh. Well, gee, too bad for them. But I mean, it doesn't really affect me. And lurking in the back is that there's less value there as in humanity than there would be if it was happening in a white suburb of Chicago or Boston or something, right? So it's a state-sponsored, you know, not consciously, I would say, but I mean this state-entitled power along with a human psychology to dismiss the other, and therefore this stuff makes sense.
I'm going to introduce it in a concept that I think it touches upon your point, and by introducing it, I recognize some people might think it's being trivial. Do you remember about 32 years ago the song "Do You Know It's Christmas" and the heat that I think was Bono got over the line "Tonight, thank God it's them instead of you," with people misinterpreting it as if he was saying it in a racist context, referring to a famine in Ethiopia, when the intent of the line was to say that there are a lot of people who reason, thank God that these woes are happening to somebody else instead of to me. And you see the parallel there when people in, you know, first world countries look at people in developing countries who are suffering. And a parallel when people look at these videos and they say, you know, at least they're the person getting beat up. At least I'm not getting beat up. But you see the same parallel there.
Well, and I think, I mean, so it's easy to drag, to pull in, I don't think it's cliche stuff, but there's the poem from the World War II, this Protestant guy in Germany who's saying, you know, first they came for the Jews, and then they came for the next group, and then they came for the next group, and when they came for me, I had no friends left, right?
Exactly.
There's no absolutely no parallel in terms of racial power, but I mean, climate hawks are also a minority, right? And and the power vested in corporations to silence and threaten minorities, it doesn't take that much to extend it to people who are protesting in general, right?
Exactly.
I mean, and I think that's, I mean, the people in the NRA talk a lot about the slippery slope if you control any gun whatsoever, right? But on the other hand, there's this slippery slope where, you know, more and more people get thrown under the bus for the benefit of, I don't know, this ideology.
And when we go to the issue of the marginalization of protests, we've talked about that before in terms of, you know, the People's Climate March and the parallels that were brought up with the anti-Iraq war protests. And you think about how, you know, the power of video, the power of image. Go back to 1965. Imagine if there were no news cameras reporting the dogs and the hoses being sicked on civil rights activists.
And what you'd have...
for all we know, we probably still have some degree of segregation legalized in this country.
Oh, I was going to say, you would have 1870, right?
Yeah,
no cameras. No, you would just have all this stuff happening in the dark, and you might hear a story about it, but it didn't really, the reality of it never set home. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and to the point about the power of image, Tom Hartman had a great segment about, you know, news organizations that don't want to show the entirety of the footage of these police shootings, presumably for fear of offending people sympathetic to law enforcement or people who believe that law enforcement can do no wrong. And I thought of the obvious parallel to when news organizations cover things like the flooding in China or the flooding in West Virginia or the drought in California, and they don't connect the dots. They don't tell the full story. They don't show the full story because they're afraid of offending certain powerful entities, including the entities that advertise on those networks. The obvious parallel there. In both cases, how media organizations that we entrust that have essentially a literal First Amendment right to explain the truth and to essentially to confront power, knuckle under to power. Right.
They dance around it, and they don't show the full, an accurate portrayal, as painful as that might be. Now, I agree with you. I mean, I think that that's particularly true. And I mean, how many people? 26 people died in West Virginia in these unheard of torrential floods, and it was just passed off as, "Gee, you know, here we had another bad rainstorm. What a coincidence!" Right?
Yep.
But I mean, I think when it comes to the question of the media, the technology that allows us to capture these things, it's just, again, this goes to a climate hawk's, it strikes at the heart of what you do, because people don't want those videos to be made. And we've talked before here about there are gag laws in agricultural states to prevent people from videotaping, discreetly or not, on these combined feedlot operations, right?
Yep.
To show the downer cow getting dragged by a tractor off to the grinder, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't want that. And there was just Apple Corporation recently patented what's called a remote kill switch, which means that someone on the network can send out a message and turn off the cell phones of and turn off the camera in all the iPhones in the neighborhood, right? So you can imagine a policeman or again, I'm not trying to throw police under the bus, but I mean, there's many good policemen. There are the few bad apples, but I mean, if those guys had a switch where they could turn off all video cameras in a half mile radius, they'd use that in a heartbeat, right?
And
they would use it against climate hawks trying to videotape a fracking operation. No doubt about it.
And to the issue of the lack of video and the lack of image, specifically with regard to the police brutality case, look at the fact that there was no footage in the Ferguson incident in 2014, that there was no camera footage of that incident, and how the lack of camera footage allowed people who were automatically defending Darren Wilson to basically to spin things his way because there is no way to do a counter spin.
Right.
And again, you know, footage is so important. Image is so important. Witness is so important that if you don't have that footage, then you got a problem.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's so much more immediate when people see it. And you're quite right. I mean, the in 1964, the images of Bull Connor with his dogs and fire hoses, that galvanized the nation, right? For better or worse. I mean, nowadays you have that again, and I think it just gets to people. I don't think I would be quite as upset if I wasn't able to see some of these images. It would just be a news report.
Yep.
Oh, dear, what a world. Well, look, I think that maybe you have some closing thought, but for me, I think it's important for climate hawks to recognize, comprehend, applaud the effort to avert police violence, to support it, to see these efforts as being a parallel effort that's trying to change the society in a profound way that Climate mm-hmm. Hearts want to do as well. And as when we can work together and we all have separate jobs, but mm-hmm. to support each other is better for everyone, for better mm-hmm. for everyone involved, right?
And it goes to the issue of everything being interconnected. There was a great post. I apologize for forgetting the writer, but she was an LGBT activist who also worked with 350.org that after the Orlando shooting, she basically made this point about how these issues are connected, that those who fight for gun reform and those who fight for LGBT rights and those who fight for a stable climate are all facing various faces of the same opponent, which is the status quo, basically. And obviously, you know, members of the Black Lives Matter movement, they're also fighting that same opponent, which is the status quo that basically says that if somebody is shot, then they must have had it coming, that sort of mentality. And the need for reform, you know, what's the old term, the blessed unrest, the thing that keeps driving people for more and more reform to make this a more perfect union. And as we see this evidence of the imperfections of the union, it basically makes people more determined for change and the various manners in which we need change.
Well, I will let you have the last word, DR. Well said. Well said. I mean, I think that this is a time for both reflection and action. And so I guess what we'll do, let me tell everybody, we'll put up some links to some of the stuff we've talked about, although it's a pretty general thing and it's all over the internet. It'll be on the blog post at massclimateaction.net/blog. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. Please listen to the show. Please share us with your friends so they can learn about us as well. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. But if you do listen to us on Stitcher, remember there's a whole stream of other shows that are behind that one that happens to be at the top of the Stitcher pile. We put out two shows a week, and you can listen to all of them. You can find us, of course, on iTunes. You can subscribe there and get us every week. So, DR, we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, DR, thank you very much for your wisdom.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.